Govinda.
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
So thank you all for coming to our Saturday program here, 26 Second Avenue. I'm happy you all could make it in spite of the rain. So what I'm told is that we are on the 19th verse of the 7th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. 7th chapter is called Knowledge of the Absolute. And Bahunam Janmanamante Gyanavanmam Prapadyante Vasudevam Sarvamiti Samahutma Sudurlabaha. That's how it goes in Sanskrit. And English we have, after many births and deaths, he who is actually acknowledged surrenders unto me, knowing me to be the cause of all causes and all that is. Such a great soul is very rare. So I'll read that again. After many births and deaths, one who is actually acknowledged surrenders unto me, knowing me to be the cause of all causes and all that is. Such a great soul is very rare. This kind of indicates that it's not often that we learn about real transcendental knowledge. Now, why would that be? It's a striking and surprising statement. And this is being made by Krishna, the Supreme Lord. He's saying that it takes many births and deaths. Of course, he's describing, and he did describe before, something about the process of reincarnation. But now he's saying after many of them, one surrenders unto God, unto me, knowing me to be the cause of all causes and all that is. This is, of course, one of the usual explanations or definitions for God, the source of everything, cause of all causes. Now, this is verse 7:19. If we go back to verse 7:3, we have a similar statement which began this chapter. And that verse is Manusyanam sahasreshu kaschid yatat siddhaye yatatamapi siddhanam kaschin me veti tatvataha. Out of many thousands among men, one may endeavor for perfection. And of those who have achieved perfection, hardly one knows me in truth. So again, we have a similar notion there, that not many people actually make it. And we're, of course, left to wonder why. The verse we're reading today explains it takes many births and deaths. The previous one says that hardly anyone actually understands God the way he really is. Now this chapter is called Knowledge of the Absolute. And the first verse starts off like this. Sri Bhagavan Ubhacha Maya Sakta Mano Ye Mam Yogam Yan Jadmanashraya Asamshayam Samagramam Yata Gyasyasi Tach Trinu. The Supreme Personality of God has said, now hear, O son of Pritha, how by practicing yoga in full consciousness of me, with mind attached to me, you will know me in full, free from doubt. And then verse 2, I shall, jnanam teham savijnanam idam vaksyami asheshataha yaj gyatva neha bhuyo nyaj yatvayam avashishyate. I shall now declare unto you in full this knowledge, both phenomenal and numinous. Thus, this being known, nothing further shall remain for you to know. So, of course, this chapter is entitled Knowledge of the Absolute. And we're going to be talking about knowledge. This is not the first chapter that dealt with the conception of knowledge. Chapter 4 also described knowledge. It started us off on the conception, the Vedic conception of knowledge. And as usual, I have too much to talk about today. So I'm going to kind of let you all decide which direction I should go, and then if I have chance to pull up some of the things that were maybe not quite so central, I'll get around to them. These are some of the things I was thinking about talking about with this chapter here. And so you hear about these sort of topics and decide which direction I should go first. One of them, of course, is Sambandha. This is the idea of what's the fix that we're in. Sambandha is the first of three Vedic conceptions that all Vedic literatures talk about. They talk about Sambandha, Abhideya, and Prayojana. Sambandha means, what is this place? Abhideya, now that I know what this place is, what should I do about it? And Prayojana is, where do I go once I've done that thing? Okay, so one thing I was thinking about talking about is Sambandha. Another is, of course, this mysterious notion that we meet in verse 2 of this chapter, phenomenal and numinous. Of course, I mentioned to some of those who were attending my Monday class that originally in Bhagavad Gita, some books say not phenomenal and numinous, but phenomenal and noumenal, which doesn't help at all because both of those words are obscure. But both of these, I think, are very interesting and important dualities that help us to understand the conception of knowledge. I could talk about that. Usually I explain the sections of chapter 7 so we kind of know where we are. I'll do that anyway. And I could talk a little bit about the yoga ladder because that figures into this whole thing. It describes why so few actually know the Supreme Lord the way that the Supreme Lord is actually situated. And of course, we'll talk about knowledge versus ignorance, because knowing and ignorance are a duality. If you know, you're not in ignorance. If you're in ignorance, you don't know. But there's all sorts of pleasant shades in between. And of course, I'll deal with this issue of why it is that so few people do know. And we'll talk a little bit about epistemology, what it means to know. All right, anybody have any particular suggestions of what's interesting that we could attack first in this group of things? Maybe.
I was interested by the yoga ladder.
The yoga ladder, okay. All right. So, yoga ladder is a principal concept that gets established in the very first part of the Bhagavad Gita. What's interesting, it relates directly to this idea of why it is that so few people actually understand God the way he is. If we look at the yoga ladder, we'll find that mostly everybody that we can know or think about fits somewhere on this sort of a hierarchy or ladder of things. And it starts off on the bottom level, the yoga ladder starts off with what we call affectionately animal life. And by animal life, we don't mean little animals running around in the forest. We mean two-legged animals that run around in cities. And so animal life means those people who make no effort at any kind of scruples or spiritual practice of any sort, and they're totally dedicated to providing pleasure in whatever way they imagine it to be, and they don't care about the consequences. That's called animal life. One lives just like the animals. Animals eat, sleep, mate, and defend. And when human beings, that's all the sum of their activities represent, eating, sleeping, mating, and defending, they are also in the category of two-legged animals. So there's a step up from that. And that step up, we usually, the next rung on the yoga ladder is a little bit better off. And that's what we call the karmakanda level, where someone has specifically, karmakanda relates to specific aspects of the Vedas which preach that one should engage in various kinds of auspicious activities. Mostly it's sacrifices. And the purpose of those is to, in a kind of religious and in a kind of pious way, to do certain things which we will know will net us good karma, and therefore we'll be materially happy as a result of that. So God may or may not figure in the picture. Usually in the karma kanda section, God doesn't figure very strongly in the picture. There's just this notion that we are doing good things, particularly in a ritualistic way, and we will get good results as a result of doing good things. That's step two. Bottom was animal life. Step two was this, karma kanda. Step three is what we usually call karma yoga. Now, karma yoga is a little different than karma kanda. Now, at least God is in the picture in karma yoga. In this way, we follow various kinds of scriptures, be it the Quran, the Vedas, the Bible, or whatever. But the idea is that we are serving God with the idea that God will in turn serve us. In other words, it's doing business with God, as I sometimes also talk about God is my waitress conception. You know that we have all these things we've done, and now we've got a list, you know, like one we kids make up for Christmas, of what kind of things we want God to reciprocate with us. That's the karma yoga section. One thing that's common to all these three, karma yoga, karma kanda, and animal life, is that the center focus of those ultimately winds up being how I can be happy by plugging things into my senses. That's what all those three things have in common. Once we move into jnana yoga, which is the fourth stage, which is above that, now we've left that. People in jnana yoga are people who are convinced that material life doesn't work. It never has and never will. Not for you, not for anybody. It's always a flop. And they know there must be something else, but they don't know what that something else is. And so they study, and they go to various groups, and they try to find esoteric literatures that talk about the nature of the mysterious, the absolute states of consciousness. We hear this word mukti, or liberation. We're not sure what we're being liberated from, and we're not very sure of what we're being liberated to, but we know that we're interested in it somehow or another. So it's kind of foggy. One thing that's for certain, in the stage of jnana yoga, you've left behind the idea that just doing what most people are doing, which is trying to figure out how to make the senses happy from moment to moment, you've left that behind, but you're not sure where you're going yet. You're somewhere in this mysterious netherworld. You know that there's various philosophies, there's mystical realizations, but all of it's kind of fuzzy and unclear. Then the stage above that is the stage that we call the Astanga yoga stage, which is where one actually doesn't think so much about processing various obscure kind of philosophy, but there's a process, and that process is yoga, and that process starts with yama and niyama. We accept certain rules, we reject certain kinds of things that are injurious to the process of yoga. And we start the Hatha Yoga process, which is stage three. And by doing the Hatha Yoga process, bending the arms and legs in various postures, one develops the ability to sit peacefully for long periods of time. And then one can develop the next stage, which is controlling the life airs by breathing. And then one goes into a mystic trance. And that's the stage that we call Astanga Yoga. Now, above that is finally the stage that we call bhakti yoga, which is a stage where one is no longer clueless about what this supreme something is. It's not a something, it's a person. That person is God. That person's name is Krishna, among other names. And now we are actually understanding that the purpose of the whole world and our own life and everything is to learn how to reawaken our love for Krishna, our love for God. If we can reawaken that, then that's the real purpose why we're here. That's the real purpose of everything. Everything falls into place at that point. And that stage is bhakti yoga. So this whole spectrum is called the yoga ladder. It moves from kind of a dim conception of what's going on in the world to full fleshed out conception of what's going on in the world. It moves from a conception where I think that the best way to live is to figure out how to make myself happy, to a conception where that's no longer the main issue in your life at all. The main issue is trying to please God. And this is not something we do in a forceful way or a stereotypic way or a limited way. It's something that happens spontaneously from the core of the heart. But it's a platform that doesn't happen accidentally. One has to build by our character by small degrees, by following certain things, regulating certain things, and eventually we come to that platform, which we call the platform of bhakti yoga. So this is part of the answer for why it is that in 7.3, Krishna says, you know, out of many thousands among people, hardly one endeavors for perfection, and out of many such perfected persons, hardly one knows me in truth. And then in this verse, where we learn that after many births and deaths, one who is actually in knowledge surrenders unto me, knowing me to be the cause of all causes and all that is, such a great soul is rare. So when you really look at it, the bulk of humanity is down there in the karma yoga, karma kanda, animal life region. There are very few people even in the jnana yoga stage, what to speak of the hatha yoga or astanga yoga stage. Very few people there. Most everybody is down there in the bottom. And why? Because it's a common misconception that what happiness is finding the right sense objects at the right time. And we grew up since babies thinking that, you know. When we were in the crib, mommy put this little rattle with a bright color, you know. Nowadays they're putting iPhones and iPads in babies' cribs. But luckily I was born early enough to escape such a fate. But, you know, from the very beginning, we're trying to figure out how to make these senses work. You know, what is it? What is this strange place I'm in? Why does it smell this way? What's that? Oh, I liked it. Hey, I didn't like that at all. Now there's something going on somewhere. I'm hurting and I'm crying and mommy's doing something. And so we spend 12 years of our lives just figuring out how to get the senses to work. And along with getting the basic understanding of how to get the senses to work, we discover we really like some things and we really don't like other things. And even though our sister or brother or the people next door, they may have a different set of things that they really like than we do. You know, we like Oreos and they don't. Or they have a dog that poops in the yard and they like the dog, but we don't like the fact that he poops in our yard. And all these kind of things. We have sensory experiences. And we learn that we like some of them, we don't like other ones. And then we, as we get older, begin to see life as a collection of moments where we filter through trying to maximize those things that we really like and trying to somehow get away from all those things that we find very unpleasant. And many people live their whole lives thinking that that's what life's all about. But actually, that's just so superficial. Life has a much deeper meaning. But to get to that deeper meaning, you have to have a certain philosophical knowledge about what's really going on in this place. What is this place? It's a strange place. You know, New York City and the rest of the whole world, too. It's a very strange place. And knowledge about what's really going on here is not easy. It's not found everywhere. And there's plenty of missing knowledge, and there's plenty of misunderstood knowledge, and there's even a good deal of disinformation to people who have made it their effort to give people something that's definitely going to lead them in the wrong direction. So all those things are nicely available, especially on the internet. And they're nicely mixed, too. So the chances that somebody will get pure knowledge are not so good, to be quite honest. They're not so good. Everywhere there's general knowledge, and even spiritual knowledge, there's kind of greater and lesser degrees of it, more complete and less complete versions of it. They're all around. Because the yoga ladder really addresses a whole worldview of different individuals. For those people who think that the whole of life is about making the senses happy, for them, they're an animal life, that's a whole worldview. And for them, they don't worry about all this other stuff. Are there spirits? Is there God? What happens after I die? Don't matter. What does matter is, am I happy? Have I got the right stuff in the icebox? What am I doing at 6:30 after I get off work? You know, what will happen then? You know, that's what matters, you know. then we go to, you know, the karma kanda people. And there are those around who very rigidly and very ritualistically do various kinds of things, which their mommy or dad did when they were little, and they continue to do them. And they've heard in their scripture, whatever it happens to be, that this was the right thing to do. And by doing it, you will get the blessings of the Supreme or something. They know, they may not even go that far. Usually they don't go that far. They just know that by doing these rituals, my life will become materially padded. It'll be nice. I'll get way more of those things that I really like. And the idea is, too, that I'll get way less those things that I really could use to not have any more of, you know. And so that's karma kanda. And the karma yoga people, they make a whole religion out of it. And we'll see in this chapter, we already discussed it, that this is religion. It isn't the highest type of religion, but it is religion, where we go to God because we want some material benefit. So we had chaturvidam bhajanti mam. Artha jigyasa artarti jnani cha bharatarshava. So we find that in this chapter, Krishna talks about four kinds of pious people, which shows that there's religion there, and there's a sense of God, but still God is my waitress, God is my order supplier. Why am I pleasing God? So God will please me. And it makes sense, it seems right. Something wrong there, but it basically is the equation that most people go by. But there's something missing there. And one of the problems there is that as long as making the senses happy is somehow or another fundamental in your life, all I got to say is good luck. If you can make it happen, you're better than most people. But most people die, you know, clutching for that last cherry of material happiness, and it just seems just outside their fingertips, because material happiness never really works. It's the big lie, the thing that you see in all the billboards, the thing you see in all the subway cars, this movie, this thing, this experience, this place, this Broadway show, this new technology coming from Apple, it's got to be Apple, and these are the things that will make us happy. And somehow, those things never really do it. So, these days, mostly people put all this stuff online, you know, whenever they buy the newest thing, they put that they just bought it, because basically that's where they get at least 50 or 70% of their so-called material happiness, is just by demonstrating to others that they just bought something. So something is very flat about this, and it's quite obvious that this is a very flat view of life, even if we're approaching God. Of course, some people are in dire straits, so they're approaching God for some kind of liberation from material torment or poverty. And so that's why we have Chaturvidya Bhajanti Mam. Where is that one? That's just back a few pages here in this particular verse, in this particular chapter. What is it?
Text 16.
It's 16? It's that far up? Okay. I was looking forward to her. Yeah. Chaturvidha bhajante mam jnana sukriti no arjuna arto jigyasir artarti jnani cha bharatarshava. O best among bharatas, four kinds of pious men begin to render devotional service to me: the distressed, the desire of wealth, the inquisitive, and he who is searching after knowledge of the absolute. So this is the antechamber, or the foyer of spiritual life. We're not in the main room yet, but we're close. And if one graduates from that, then all the better. Sometimes people don't graduate from that, but they rather move up to jnana yoga. But these days that doesn't happen so often. Mostly, people do not move into jnana yoga, not in any real sense of the word. Jnana means that one is really serious about what the world is about, and they're serious enough that they're going to give up this moment-to-moment search after what's the next thing that I want to get to make my senses feel warm and fuzzy. That's the thing that you give up to really move into jnana yoga. Now, that's why once we get above these bottom three, the pyramid starts to narrow to a very small spike with just a few people. And then those who actually practice yoga, wow, those are really, you know, I mean, there's a lot of people who do yoga, but not as a spiritual discipline. If you're doing yoga as a spiritual discipline, that's very rare. And finally, we have those who are bhaktas, those who actually recognize it. Yes, we should focus on God, but not as God being my order supplier. I'm supposed to be actually trying to give myself to God. The funny thing about it is that when you actually give yourself to the Supreme, you feel happy in a way that nobody else can describe. It's not about what you have or don't have. It's not about what you did or didn't do. It's not about what people say about you or don't say about you. It's about your relationship. And that's the mystery that's missing from all these other lower aspects of the yoga ladder. We don't know about this mysterious relationship with God. And we think that a relationship with God is just, you know, kind of thinking that we have one, or imagining that we do. But the Vedic literature, particularly the Vaishnav Vedic literature, describes that we move from the point of just having this kind of fuzzy or sense that God must exist to an actual relationship, exactly the same way we have a relationship with anyone else. Of course, since it's God, this relationship opens itself up to divine ecstasies. And these are possible. They are not pie in the sky. They are not mythical. They actually exist. But to do that, one has to follow a gradual process of regulating the senses and of doing devotional activities. And if we do that, then we move from the karma yoga section, which we might be, or the karma kanda or the animal life. You can go directly from any place on the yoga ladder to any other place. So if you finally learn about it, then you go straight to the top. And though you're not perfected by any means, at least you know what's really going on. For the first time, you know what's really going on. And you know where you are and where you want to be, which is, you know, what most people don't really understand. So, of course, these things all sound nice and theoretical, but if you practice them, you find out that this is not at all theoretical. It's just as scientific as anything else could be. That if you engage in the processes of bhakti yoga, you will discover that you begin to awaken your real relationship with God. It doesn't come all at once, or you might get some indications of it in the very beginning, but it opens gradually. From God being a concept, we find that by chanting first, we hear Nam. Then after Nam comes Rup. We begin to see the image. Then there comes Gun, which is the qualities of God become palpable to us. We begin to be able to recognize them and appreciate them in a very intimate way. And finally, Lila. We're actually drawn in to what's going on outside of this murky, dark material world, which is the eternal pastimes of the Supreme, which are happening right now, and we are completely oblivious to them. So that's a little bit about the yoga ladder and a little bit about why it is that we say that after many births and deaths, because usually during many births and deaths, we are not really going up this yoga ladder very fast. We like being in one spot on it, and we want to stay there. We don't want to go to the next step up. So Krishna doesn't force. You want to stay wherever you are, fine. The material world's going on forever. And, you know, you can stay here as long as you want. The catch is, it's not a nice place, but you can stay here as long as you want. But if you're intelligent, you will try to get out of here. All right, so I want to ask, are there any questions about any of that? And then we'll talk about some other aspect of this particular chapter. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I wish I had. Yeah, there we go. We have a map here. You see this painting on the wall here? In the lotus flower, that is what we call Goloka Vrindavan. Of course, this is not drawn to scale, and, you know, there's a lot of other things here. But this is Goloka Vrindavan. That's where Krishna is with all of his associates, his intimate associates, and his pastimes there are going on 24/7. We don't see that world. Why? Because we're down in that dark cloud below it. That is called the material world. And it's not just one universe, but millions of universes are down there. And it's like a dark cloud. And each of those universes has thousands of planets in them. And we chase our material desires and get pounded and benedicted by our various karma in one of those planets on one of those universes down there. If you look real close, you can probably see Manhattan down there. But that's the material world. That's what's below the lotus. Those blue planets, that's called, the blue is the spiritual sky, and those globes are spiritual universes, and those are presided over by a four-handed form of Krishna, various Vishnu forms. And there, people also serve the Supreme, but they do so more or less in what we call dasya ras, or the relationship of service. But in the world of the lotus in the center, we have the three intimate relationships, which are sakya ras, friendship, the rasa of parental affection called vatsalya ras, and the rasa of conjugal love, which is called madhurya ras. So the three upper relationships exist in the world, and the rest of it exists, relationship of servitorship exists out in the spiritual sky, or the blue and the planets there. And if we don't want to cooperate with the Supreme, fine, we're in the dark cloud down there at the bottom of the material world. So this is going on all the time, but we don't have any clue about it. You can't see it with the telescope. Hubble's not going to be able to get out that far. And the material universe has coating over the outside, which makes the spiritual world completely invisible, at least to science and the mundane world. However, if one penetrates with devotional love, one can see the spiritual world even here. We don't even need a telescope. But it's a matter of consciousness. So the spiritual world is a million miles away or right next to us, depending on our consciousness. If we change our consciousness, we can participate in the spiritual world, even now, before we leave this body. And if we get there when we do leave the body, then we will definitely go there and not take another body. We have a body now, a spiritual body, but that body is ensconced in a material vehicle, this thing. And so we don't know much about that spiritual body. It's rather the driver that's driving this thing around. And the whole idea of this cycle of reincarnation is to break out of it and go back to the spiritual world where these relationships are actually eternal. They go on forever. Yeah.
So when a pure devotee departs this world, does he or she go directly to Goloka Vrindavan to partake in the eternal pastimes of Krishna, or does he or she go to other planets to partake in further instructions given by Krishna or his spiritual master?
Well, all those things can happen. Depends on how, A, Krishna wants to work it out. It also depends on, B, how far along a pure devotee is, you know. Sometimes they may go directly back to Krishna Loka, if that's what Krishna wants. He doesn't want them to preach anymore. He wants them just to come back. And they have no material ambitions, so they would feel happy being in Krishna's planet. And so they can go back there. Other times, what we do find is that instead of that, Krishna allows a devotee one last birth in the material world in a location where his pastimes are happening in the material world. So Krishna has, on a cyclic basis, on a recurring kind of schedule, he comes to this material world and exhibits his pastimes. And those who are almost ready to leave the material world, they take their last birth in the intimate associates of the Supreme Lord when he's manifesting his pastimes in this material world. And then after that, they go back home, back to Godhead. So any one of those things can happen depending on the desire of the Supreme, the advancement of the individual, etc. Any other questions about that part? So, yeah.
When you speak about pastimes, are you referring to something or cumulative moments that have already played out and they're unfolding?
Pastimes does have that indication for it. It doesn't really come from the past. It's pastimes means activities. You know, in Sanskrit it's called lila. There's no connotation of it being necessarily historic or having already occurred. Of course, there are unlimited things going on. This is one of the things that most people, unless you've studied the Vedic literature, have no clue about. That the spiritual world is not at all like, you know, Casper the Friendly Ghost or something like this, or, you know, some cloud where people are roaming around and they're wearing white robes. The spiritual world is full of form and variety. In fact, there's more form and variety there than there is in this world. In fact, this world is like a two-dimensional version of the supreme spiritual world. And, of course, since everything is eternal there, there are some things which happen over and over again, but those things which happen over and over again, they always have some new angle to them. And the Supreme Lord is having relationships with all of his limitless parts and parcels, namely you and me and all those who never decided to come here. We did, but others decided never to come here. And so they're currently enjoying relationships with the Supreme. And these are, it's like a party all day long, and various things are going on. Technically, there's something called Astakaliya Lila, which there are eight different kinds of pastimes that happen throughout the day. And then there are special things that happen, and there are special activities. And the Supreme Lord is like the most amazing playwright. He understands how to engineer circumstances, relationships, people, material, or not really material, but physical objects and so on and so forth. He can orchestrate the whole thing to create a new dynamic with something new that brings out the way that his intimate devotees interact with him. And they interact with him different ways based on different relationships. So all this is simultaneously going on in the spiritual world. So pastime means these various kinds of relationships. And the purpose of these various relationships is to invoke or evoke various kinds of rasas or relationships. Yeah.
So all these things, like we what we may call our life, doing this, doing that, going to talk to this person or go to work, live and die, you know, sleep, mate, and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Are all of those activities, functions, being played out from Krishna the Supreme? So is he really the original source of all of our activities?
Well, yes and no. We have a choice. We can choose to cooperate with the Supreme, or we can choose to be completely uninterested in the Supreme. That's our basic choice. That's what our free will allows. If we want to not cooperate with the Supreme, or we come here to the material world, the material world is interesting because it's a virtual reality that allows us to play out our various conceptions of happiness in a three-dimensional realm that never actually do net happiness at the very end of it, but it allows us to play them out as we conceive them. And in this way, we can live lifetime after lifetime in our, you know, romper room playground here in the material world. And we always notice that we never really get satisfied. We always notice that something is missing there, and we usually don't figure it out. One of these days, we do figure it out. We realize that the reason that we don't actually get any juice out of the things we're doing is we've disconnected from the Supreme. We want to once again be part of that real drama, not this fake one that we're doing now. Sometimes it's called our God project, you know. We decided that we didn't want to cooperate with God's, Leela, what he's doing. All right, so he doesn't force. We want to do something else. Great. We come to this material world, and now in this material world, to us, each of us in our individual ego imagines that we are God in some kind of way, and we are trying to enjoy the material world. Of course, it never works, it flops, but we can go ahead and do it as many times as we want until we get that little birdie flies in finally and says, this is dumb, stop doing it. And we start the process of reconnecting with the Supreme again. Does that make sense? Okay. So his Leela in the spiritual world is fully directed by him, and we're all willing participants and co-creators of it in some senses. In the material world, we're kind of turning our back on that, and instead he's created something called the external energy, and we're not interacting with him directly. We're interacting with his external energy. And it is sometimes providing those things that we like and sometimes not, depending on our past karma. And so the material world is always this shady world where things half work and half don't, and nothing ever lasts forever, and we keep getting recycled. It's a giant recycling plant, the whole material world. And on top of it, there's this mysterious element called karma that arranges for us to suffer the reactions of things we did that harmed others. And sometimes, for things we did that helped others, we get the opposite of that, good karma. We get that comes back to us in some kind of way. And that's that kind of mysterious dynamic behind the world that we live in. Yes, Chorna.
All this scientific development and technological development, many of them are for the good of the material world.
Mm-hmm.
So how Lord Krishna's Leela comes to this at all times, or not?
I follow what you said, but I don't follow the last part.
Oh. Where is Krishna's pastime when all these are being developed and many are helpful for material life, human life, materially? Where is the Lord Krishna's power or pastime in this?
Well, what I'm going to try to do is I'm going to say some things, and you can tell me whether it answered your question or not. And this brings me to the next thing that I was going to talk about, which happens to be knowledge. And before, I was generally saying that there are two kinds of knowledge. There's spiritual knowledge, and there's material knowledge, sometimes called apara and para vidya. Para vidya is spiritual knowledge, apara vidya is material knowledge. But actually, I think it's more helpful if we think of three kinds of knowledge, because there's this knowledge in the gray area between that really makes a difference, that we distinguish it, and that is knowledge about, speculative knowledge about philosophy. So now, I like to talk about, you know, what I call bhukti vidya, or material knowledge specifically, which is knowledge about how to enjoy the material world better and how to eliminate suffering in the material world in a material way. That's what we call scientific knowledge, the whole shooting match, you know, which we can call bhukti gyan or bhukti vidya, the knowledge of how to enjoy the material world. And that's what we have in all the colleges, and everywhere you go, you see these giant buildings with libraries that probably cost zillions of dollars and all these kinds of books. And that, we are saying, is apara vidya, or in this case, we're calling it bhukti vidya, knowledge directed toward material satisfaction. Secondly, we have this knowledge that we are reading about here in Bhagavad Gita, which I call bhakti jnana or bhakti vidya. It's the knowledge of how to perform devotional service. What do we mean by devotional service? What is it? What isn't it? And this is very essential knowledge. And then in between the two, we have something that I am calling now mukti vidya or mukti jnana. Jnana or knowledge related to liberation, whatever that means. You know, I kind of leave the word kind of ill-defined, because usually people who are searching after liberation don't actually know what it means. You know, it may mean be liberated from material suffering. It may mean being liberated from form. It may mean being liberated from material conceptions. It may mean being liberated from this body. All kinds of conceptions are there when we talk about liberation. We take liberation to mean being liberated from material selfish desire. That's what we say it is. But then when we're talking about that, we're really talking about bhakti jnana. So this knowledge pertaining to various philosophies, various speculations about the nature of the universe, the supreme, states of consciousness, all that stuff, that's what I call mukti jnana, the knowledge of liberation. So the Supreme, he actually gives us bhakti jnana. And these others, especially scientific knowledge, it's good for what it is. If we want to do something in the material world to increase our ability to achieve some material purpose, then we need this kind of scientific knowledge. Even sometimes we use material scientific knowledge in the service of the Supreme. It's not impossible to do. But basically, when we say that we have knowledge, usually what most people from the Western world think is immediately they imagine all these libraries and various colleges and, you know, the Smithsonian and all this kind of thing. They think of this grand bulwark of accumulated ideas and principles that scientists, historians, and et cetera, have amassed and put together. And some of this knowledge is useful, and some of it has philosophical paradigms embedded in it that are actually very misleading. And so that's why this bhukti jnana is a shady area. Sometimes it's useful, sometimes it's not. If we try to look towards this material knowledge to get absolute or philosophical knowledge, we'll certainly be misled, because the material world is far too complex to draw conclusions from the kind of setup that most scientists perform on this material world. So it's useful, we use it, I certainly use it. I've got nothing against, computers and all that stuff. I certainly use that too. I'm trying to use it in the service of Krishna. But some people use material science as a platform for preaching atheism or they use it as a platform for trying to show some philosophical thing, which is really outside the scope of that scientific piece of information. So I wanted to bring that into it all. Does that answer your question? Is that in the same direction? Okay. Because I think that anyone who's serious about spiritual life will hit this all-pervading propaganda, which is called by some scientism, which means seeing science as a religion in itself, seeing science as kind of an anti-religion or a null religion, where we assume that there's nothing going on, just us molecules down here, and all this other stuff is hocus pocus, you know, Shazam stuff. It doesn't exist. And this is being more and more shoved in our faces everywhere you turn, in the media, certainly in academia, where if you go to any kind of college or whatever it is, this is mainstream, this idea that whatever we know through science. Anything outside of science is folk stuff, you know, mythology, hocus pocus, etc., etc., usually with the understanding that it's be better left alone. And some people really get their whole worldview from this conception. And this is what we also talked about in this chapter, in chapter 7. Besides these chaturvida bhajanti mam, you know, these pious people who surrender, we had four impious people who don't surrender. The, you know, the mudha, the naradhama, the asuram bhavam ashrita, and finally the mayaya parhita gyan. So this was also, I think, 15:7:15. We go back there. Yeah. The miscreants who are grossly foolish, those who are lowest among mankind, those whose knowledge is stolen by illusion, who partake of the atheistic nature of demons, do not surrender unto me. So namam duskritina mudha prapajante naradhama mayaya parhita jnana asuram bhavam ashritam. So there were four classes there. So these are asuras, or people who have an anti-spiritual attitude. And mudha means someone who's, in Sanskrit, an ass. Someone who, actually that's what the word means, you know, that someone who is very low in their thinking and sees only what makes them materially happy, and they don't think anything beyond that. Then naradhama is someone who's a little more elevated than that, who actually has material facility and is higher placed in society, but such a person also has no conception of the Supreme. And then we have the asuram bhavam ashrita, the avowed atheist, who rants against God whenever they get the opportunity. And then we have the mayaya parhita jnana, that person who actually has some intellectual capacity and uses it to try to explain to people that God cannot, does not exist, or is immaterial, whichever way. So those are the other kind. So these are people who are definitely not going to make any spiritual progress. They're not in the wings like the other four were. So what we're seeing here is this whole chapter is dedicated to the conception of knowledge. So whenever we look at knowledge, we're also going to have to look at side by side what ignorance is, because the two are a duality. To understand knowledge, we understand ignorance. To understand ignorance, we can understand knowledge. So between the two of them, we get a good idea of what the Vedas actually mean by knowledge. When the Vedas discuss transcendental knowledge, oftentimes that adjective is there, transcendental, they mean knowledge about the performance of bhakti and liberation in the sense of being liberated from our material selfish desires. That's what we mean by transcendental knowledge. When we talk about mundane knowledge, we usually mean the other two things. In other words, technical knowledge about how to increase our sense gratification, and knowledge about various philosophical theories that are neither here nor there. So we are trying to focus on this real definition of knowledge, what this chapter is really about. Krishna is trying to explain that knowledge is transcendental knowledge, knowledge about what this place really is. So, again, we see why it is that so few people come to that. I mean, who in the world would ever think God is blue and he plays a flute? It's not something that you would ever figure out. It's not something you would come to by basing something on logic. Because the only way you could know that is by descending authority. And we might say, well, that's just what I've always heard, this whole dogma stuff. But actually, it's not exactly like that. That when you really look at it, basic philosophical principles have to have a foundation. Oftentimes people think that we have philosophies and they start with basics. But actually, the basics are part of what you start with. You know, if you take a look at it, if we wonder what this universe is, you've got three possible answers, maybe four. One of them is that the material universe comes from God. There's an intelligence beyond this universe, and this intelligence created the universe. In some ways, that's illogical. You know, that there's this something or another. If the universe couldn't exist by itself, how does this all-intelligent being exist before it? So it appears illogical. And there's no way we can prove it. And there's no way we can disprove it. And we don't have any real evidence one way or the other because we don't see universes being created today. Now let's look at the other possibilities. That this universe just happened by chance. Again, that's illogical. And there's no way you can prove it or disprove it. And it has problems of itself. And then there's another possibility that the universe was always here. Again, it's illogical. So basically, we have to recognize that there's some things that can't be arrived at through logic and reason or any kind of scientific evidence because it's just beyond that. And so you pick whichever one you feel actually is the most reasonable conclusion. Of course, when we're talking about science, we're talking about being able to demonstrate something to a lot of different people with a lot of different attitudes in a way that's conclusive enough that they'll all accept it. Now, that will never happen on the philosophical level because people already have a philosophy before they start to look at things. So before you start to look at things, you already have a philosophy. And the question is that philosophy very broad or is that philosophy very narrow? If it's very broad, then you'll be able to explain the world and the way it's working in a very simple way. And you'll also be able to walk through it without stubbing your toe all the time. So that's what we mean by expansive philosophy. Although Krishna does not force any philosophy on anybody, and you're quite welcome to believe any kind of philosophy you want, either an expansive one or a narrow one, one that works, one that doesn't work, one that's full of contradictions or one that isn't, one that's got a lot of stuff to it or one that's got a teeny bit of stuff to it. It's your call. Nobody's forced. If you do have a very wide philosophy, then you are in a position to understand your own life, understand other people's lives, in a position to actually help yourself, help others, and you will eventually meet the Supreme Lord face to face if you have an actual open philosophy. If your philosophy is less than that, then to some extent you will have less of a good chance, less of a an understanding of how things are working and why they're working. So we have to have a basis to start with things. And some people think that science explains everything. But in fact, all these rooms full of books, scientific books and technical books, what do they explain? They certainly talk about things that work on an empirical level. As long as we're happy with just using things so that we can make the material world more to our liking, as long as that's our goal, then material science gets the job done. And there's a lot of disclaimers on scientific knowledge that most people never realize, you know. We hear about these things, we study them, and we're up against them shoulder to shoulder all the time. You know, we have all sorts of scientific ideas all the way around us. You know, if you go to school, you learn about E equals MC squared, you learn about math. If you go to some kind of mechanics or engineering school, you learn about F equals MA. You learn all these formulae and all these different things. But aren't these facts? Well, as long as we're willing to take the disclaimers that go with them, you know, what kind of disclaimers am I talking about? Well, for one, every so-called material fact that we can point to in the scientific world out there, every so-called material scientific fact has several issues. One of them is it true for all time? In other words, is it temporal? Does it change in the future? If I ask you a simple question, how many people are there in the United States? You can give me an answer if you happen to know. But if I ask you 10 years from now, you won't give the same answer. That's because it's not a static thing. You're asking about something that changes. If you ask me, what's the weather tomorrow? I can be the best meteorologist in the world, and I can give you an answer. And if you ask me next week, what's the weather tomorrow, I'll give you a different answer. Because certain things about the material world are constantly changing. So every scientific fact may be or may not be changing. And how soon or how quickly it changes is a good question. We never know the answer to that question. There's an interesting book that I just read by someone named Samuel Arbesman called The Half-Life of Facts. And he talks about how in scientific publications that professional literature tosses out things on a regular basis. That basically he shows this whole thing how roughly about, I think, you know, in sets of 10 years, you know, in 10 years, 80% of the stuff that was written 10 years ago is relevant. In 20 years, 70% is relevant. And by the time you get to 45 years, 20 or 30% of what was written before is no longer relevant. And in some fields, it's changing even faster, you know. So medical knowledge is particularly bad. Physics seems to hold on to things a little longer. But these things were at one time in accredited mainstream journals. And they were written up, but now, you know, 45 years later, most of these things we don't believe, and they have changed. So this is called the half-life of facts. Even things we take very solidly. So first thing about science and the facts that come from material science is that it's changing. The conceptions are changing. Another thing about it is it's never complete. There's always missing pieces. That whatever we study, we're studying only a certain percentage of it. There's some part of it that we don't know about, you know. Whenever we look at scientific formula, we find that it's an abstraction. It's a mathematical formula that we've had, at least theoretically at some point, somebody go through these experiments, and by plotting these experiments and doing them over and over again, they came to a mathematical formula. But sometimes there may be hidden factors that we don't know. And those hidden factors blow a hole sometimes in what we're doing. You know, as engineers, people pump these math figures all the time, and it's reasonable to do that. Most of the time they work. Planes don't fall out of the sky. Sometimes they do. MH370. But somehow, you know, generally we see that mostly it works. Occasionally things don't work. But again, we never have complete knowledge. We know something about DNA, but we don't really know why the cell does what it does, why one cell does something else, another one does something else. We know some things about it, but not everything about it. Every bit of scientific knowledge we have has holes in it. That's not a, you know, a basement of science, but it does show that everything we have is on shaky territory. Everything we know, as long as we're willing to accept that knowledge may be temporal, that may not be the same tomorrow, or that knowledge is limited, that there's certain things left out, then we can go ahead and use science, knowing that that may be part of what we're taking a gamble with. Another thing about science, we never know anything completely accurately. It's always approximate. Everything is an approximation. One time I read this quote by Albert Einstein where he said that as far as mathematics is concerned, it's always approximate. And as far as mathematics is not approximate, it is not concerned with the real world. So if it's exact, then it's in the world of math, and it doesn't really relate to this one. If it's approximate, then it relates to this one, but then it's not exactly pure math because we never know how deep to go with the math. Yeah.
Maharaj, but I mean, I appreciate the point you just made about material science having all these holes, and it's merely full of theories and nothing is definite. But what about in a sense of religion, when we come to religion? What if we see that the orthopraxy of the religion deviates somewhat or substantially from the orthodoxy and the teachings of the religion? Are there holes in the teachings and the scriptural aspect of the religious science, or is it just people just not, you know, being fully independent? Are there holes in the teachings and the doctrine of the religion itself, or is it just sort of a bunch of people running amok?
Right, right. Well, let's put... You've asked several things, and I'll answer it with this, which may get your point, or it may not. You can tell me. Just as with material science, spiritual science is never complete. There's always something more, you know. The material world is infinitely dense, and it has infinite, things that the scientists study some of, and they have to leave certain things aside because there's just not time to study everything, even if you have so many scientists. Same thing with spiritual truths. You can understand the basic things and the important things, but always in the details there's gray areas where it's not penciled in. And that's why we have the Association of Devotees and we have scripture that helps us to kind of draw a dotted line through that area where we might not be so clear. And we see that mostly a lot of these things have been penciled in, but that doesn't exclude the possibility of future things coming up. And that's why those who have given their lives to spiritual life, they get an insight from the Supreme on how to deal with these things. Now, another aspect is that the various religions of the world may have a greater or lesser conception of what this whole framework is. So if you have a greater conception, naturally you will have more to work with, and you will be able to, you know, be on the money more with what really should be done and what should be avoided. If you don't have so much, and in fact the general philosophy is encumbered with mistaken ideas, then you'll, in that point, the religion will find its way kind of befuddled, you know, about various things. So what we try to do here is to explain the philosophy of Krishna consciousness, and to a certain extent, you will also hear that it is pratyakshava, that it is directly perceived. That happens in the ninth chapter. That verse comes up. So the spiritual philosophy should be A, not self-contradictory. B, it should be expansive. It should cover a lot of subjects. And C, it should be plausible. In other words, it shouldn't conflict with what we see all the time. So we understand things by those criteria, and we also understand that my guru, sadhu, and shastra, that the literature says one thing, and those literatures have been commented upon, not only by Prabhupada or a recent acharyas, but also by acharyas in the distant past. So is there a consistency there? And in that way, we have faith that the consistency is being maintained throughout. You know. Maybe, did that answer your question, or did I miss some aspect of what you were actually asking?
I'll take it offline.
Okay. Okay. All right. Any questions about what we just discussed? Anything further? Because knowledge is very important. We say that knowledge is secondary to devotion. If you have devotion, you don't need knowledge. But the problem is none of us have it. So we have to develop knowledge on how to get devotion, not just any kind of knowledge. We want particularly bhakti vidya, or the knowledge directed towards bhakti. If we know what bhakti is, we also simultaneously know what it isn't. We know what to avoid, what to embrace, and over time we see that this is not just, you know, some kind of dogma or airy-fairy stuff. It actually works. That we are impressed by the scope of the things that are in the Vedas, how it describes the material world, how it describes humans, how it describes love, how it describes relationships, how it describes how things came into being. But more, we are impressed later by how, if we follow the principles we call sadhana bhakti, or regulated practice of devotion, we find that we get a whole refurb job done on our consciousness. We are different people. We find little by little that we become gradually moving away from more selfish, more kind of self-centered and foolish activities. And we find that over time, even our desires change. We're not so much attracted and glued to the kind of funky things in this world that we know would be, our life would be better off without. It doesn't happen because we're forcing ourselves, but it happens because we genuinely start to lose our attraction. So one of the things we say as a scientific method is that if you try the process of bhakti, it should be changing your heart, it should be changing your consciousness, the way you feel about things, the way you see the world. If it isn't, something's wrong, you know. And actually that should be the test of any religion or any philosophy, that if you apply the philosophy, does it change your life? Does it change your consciousness? Do you find yourself actually beginning to be interested in this mysterious person that most people call God, but we call Krishna? Who is this person? Can I know something about it? And by engaging in the process of bhakti, we learn philosophically about him, but in time we meet him. Any other questions? Yeah,
Matthew. A little bit earlier about Nama, Rupa, Guna, and
yeah,
Lila.
Right.
Is this a progression of realization?
Yeah, it is, actually.
As one pursues spiritual life? Because right now we're engaged in kirtan, we're doing japa, so is that us being in the Nam stage?
Yeah, yeah.
And then...
Then comes Rupa, then Lila, and then... I mean, Rupa, then Guna, and then Lila.
And so what does that mean, to perceive Rupa?
Well, you begin to actually see the form of the Supreme. Mm-hmm. Exactly how that manifests, I don't know, I haven't heard the details spelled out. And then there's the idea of actually being palpably aware of the Supreme Lord's qualities, mm-hmm. you know. Right now we read about Krishna as the most attractive. We read about the fact that Krishna is the... we read about Krishna's love, we read about Krishna's humor, we read about these things, but they're just things that we read about, you know. But when you come to that stage, you actually experience those things. They mean something to you, and just like you meet somebody, you may have read about a particular individual, but when you actually meet them, you have a direct experience. So that's what I would say.
Created vision, or
Krishna actually appears to us.
Created one in mind, or it comes.
Yeah, it's a realized. Krishna manifests it. Of course, there's no harm in thinking about Krishna's form in the mind, just thinking about it. We have all kinds of pictures and deities, etc. But there's a time when Krishna's visage becomes actually manifested to us.
But if, suppose I see Krishna in a dream, would that be anything?
Might be. The Supreme Lord comes in many ways. That's always fortunate. If we're getting some instruction, then we should always check that instruction that we're getting in a dream with scripture and the spiritual master to see if it concurs, because we also might be getting some kind of other false idea. Dreams are never fully reliable, but... So we're in the 19th verse again here of chapter 7. We learn that after many births and deaths, the reason there's many births and deaths is because we are not ready to really surrender everything to the Supreme Lord. And we would probably never be ready to do that, but somehow or another, by great fortune, we met devotees or somebody who said to us, hey, wait, check this out. And because we did, we were somehow attracted by the philosophy, and now we're on a path that not many people tread. And that's all right. But we are, part of that path is to go out and help other people to understand it. And that's a part of our process too. And that's why there is so few people who actually know Krishna in truth, or as we say here, such a great soul is rare, because for the most part, people are really, their whole life revolves around material happiness, being able to satisfy their material desires from moment to moment. And if that's what our life revolves around, then certainly we're not going to be able to have the time or the space or the right consciousness to understand the Supreme the way he really is. Doesn't matter whether we're doing it in a religious way or a non-religious way. Either way, we won't actually punch through. So that's the mystery of why the Supreme, knowledge about the Supreme is very rare, and why we're talking about all these many births. As long as you want something else, the material world will help you to get it. You won't be happy, but the material world will be there and offer it to you, and you can chase it, no problem. And you can take birth again and do the same thing all over again, no problem. No one will ever kick you out of here. There's no eviction. You can just keep coming back and back. But eventually, we all come to the recognition that this is not a good way to spend the eternity, that we can get out of this cycle and go back to the spiritual world. So I'm going to cap it off there. Any other questions before we... Yeah. Yeah. It's a good question, too. Some things about Krishna are just his personal particular preference. Why he's blue. I've never heard anybody explain why he's blue. He just is blue, you know. We could say maybe because out of all the races that we know people have different skin colors, you know, red, white, black, and orange, or rather yellow, et cetera, but no race that I know of is blue. So in one sense, you know, nobody can claim that, you know, I'm in that race that the Supreme is. So in that sense, he's kind of a part. But that really doesn't explain it. You know, what really we understand is there's certain things about Krishna that are just his personal choice, and there's not much beyond that, you know, to say. Yeah.
Krishna is called the dolphin.
What's that?
Krishna.
Yeah.
Is called the dolphin.
Yeah.
So he can be blue and he can be dolphin as well, correct?
Well, it's described that he's the color of a monsoon rain cloud, which is simultaneously black and blue at the same time. So some people think of it as black and some people think of it as blue. It's a dark blue, like a monsoon rain cloud. Some cases you'll see him depicted in bright, you know, baby blue or something like that. But usually that's not the more accurate version. He should be a darkish blackish blue.
Person measure to what extent the person is progressing in the effort to realize.
Yeah, well, that's simple. To the extent that you're always thinking about Krishna and trying to do things for Krishna, to the extent you're trying to give Krishna to others, to that extent you know that you're making progress. Otherwise, there's no real way to know. And of course, we should see that we're developing 26 qualities of devotee. You know, we should see that gradually unseemly qualities are not so manifest in our character, and the diametric opposite virtues are more visible. It won't be there all at once, but we should see that if we're actually making progress, that good qualities should be arriving and bad qualities should be exiting. So should we have another? Yeah.
So we should thank Chandrasekhar Swami over here. If you want after the kirtan, please feel free. I think Maharaj wouldn't mind if you go up and say hello, ask him some questions. He also speaks regularly at the Brooklyn Temple of Radha Govinda Mandir on, I believe, Wednesday nights, right?
Yeah, Monday and Wednesday.
Okay. And Maharaj is really very expert in the Bhagavad Gita, so ask him any question, you know, take advantage while he's here.
Does anyone here not know about the Rath Yatra in Manhattan?
Yeah, that was part of the announcements I'm going to make.
If you don't, okay, I've got cards for it too. That's so,
great.
If anybody does.